The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
Hi, this is Kelly Parton. I'll be reading We Who Have Returned from the Dead by Terry J. Babcock. I'd like to dedicate this reading to my father, Dr. Burke F. Parton, who was a huge science fiction fan, and he passed away in 2016. My first memory is of red, arterial red, the deep, rich color of blood, of tissue, the exact color of the artificial womb they made for me. I spent my first 2 years in a pouch, like a marsupial. I still don't know whether the Neen thought that was the way human infants were raised, or just a good idea on their part. They are creative, the Neen, and their curiosity is vast. I am here in this recreated environment on this sheltered moon as a representative of a species that once covered my origin planet. I've never been there. The origin world is far, and it has changed. The Neen have shown me pictures of the planet, its ecosystems, the specialized environment my species built for themselves. The pictures confuse me, and when I ask what the constructed things are or their purpose, the Neen do not answer. I think they might have been expecting me to have some deeply programmed understanding of this world, of these things my ancestors made. If so, I have disappointed. But they find my longing to stand on the world of my origin intriguing. They had not expected genetically programmed sentimentality. One of them told me that the cetaceans also long for Earth. Earth. It is a strange-sounding word. I thought the Neen were pronouncing it incorrectly because of their mandibles, but they tell me it is correct. They have recordings of the sound. The cetaceans are of far more interest to the Neen than humans. The Neen are terrestrial, and their knowledge is overwhelmingly of species that are land-based. Perhaps that is why they are fascinated with the whales. The Neen were disappointed at my inability to communicate with them. They assumed it would be a given. Two creatures from the same planet with such large brains? The Neen wanted to know why, despite many years, the whales will not breed. The Neen birthed the whales first, and other aquatic animals second, and the terrestrial ex-aquatics next, the elephant and rhinoceros. We humans were fifth. I learned this from a young Neen, who told me with the tone of speaking to one who is arrogant. I spoke back with speaking to one who is judging, asking what I had done to be called so.
You, nothing,
the Neen said.
But this one knows your type. Neen have studied many worlds, a multitude of species and ecosystems. In species with your particular presentation, the characteristic of arrogance is highly conserved. We have studied such groupings as your predecessors many times. This is why you are fifth.
He flicked his antenna at me in dismissal. By fifth, he meant me to understand, not important. There is nothing I can do that will surprise them. Except talk to whales, that would surprise them. I am allowed certain things, math and language and art. They scan my brain while I am learning. They believe in studying living things. They have a mate for me, but I find him dull. I am allowed to see the cetaceans, if I ask permission. The tank has walls of glass, and if a dolphin sees you waiting, they will come up alongside and look at you with one eye. I wonder if they find me as interesting as I find them. I feel a strange urge to join them in the water, but this is not permitted.
You will die,
the Neen explained.
Their physiology permits long periods underwater between breaths. Yours does not.
The great whales and their little sisters, the dolphins, sing sometimes. In their song I hear sorrow, a longing for home. How did my ancestors die? I am speaking with a Neen egg layer, one with patience.
We do not know,
said the egg layer.
We found a cache of preserved gametes and embryos on an ice moon of the largest gas giant in the system. Their sun was enlarged, entering the red dwarf phase. There were also recordings, a stable data storage system of elegant design. The pictures you saw, the language you speak, came from the cache. They knew their system would die, as all things must. "Permit me to leave you,"
it said abruptly.
"I must feed."
Neen eat a great deal during breeding cycle. Making eggs has a high calorie cost. They breed in cycles, egg makers entering the crevice to lay in mass, the sperm producers following, spraying the spongy masses of eggs that cling to the sides of the rock walls. Fertilized eggs absorb the unfertilized eggs first, then the tadpoles grow and consume each other. By the second molting, each larva has consumed hundreds of its siblings. The ones that survive fifth molt are taken and fed by adults. Subsequent moltings will determine their role and position. It is strange to watch those who have crawled from the breeding pits covered in spume, survivors and practitioners of cannibalism, exhibit such tender care for other species young. But they do. They value all living things. I go to the pool again. The dolphins glide past, looking at me with one eye, then the other. They sing. I put my head against the glass and try to sing back, but it doesn't come out right. The dolphins hover, watching me with merry dark eyes, their mouths open. It seems to me they are laughing. The Neen have given me full access to the cache's data. I am overwhelmed. There is a lifetime's worth of study. I do not know how to thank you, I tell the Neen.
Help us understand,
the Neen say.
That is thanks enough.
I have never thanked them for my life. Neen do not. They earn theirs in the pits. One does not give thanks for what one has earned. I go to see the whales. I sit at the tank edge and dangle my feet in the water. The dolphins come to the edge as always. Most always there are one or two Neen around, but now there are none. Just us, I say to the dolphins. We earthers. One takes my ankle in his mouth, and suddenly I am in the water, panicked, flailing. But the dolphins bear me up between them, so my head is above water. The water is salt. I drink some, but don't like it. The dolphin swims slowly towards the middle of the tank. The tank is large. The Neen knew the big whales traveled far. The dolphins switch out, new ones taking their place, and I kick with my feet, enjoying the feel of moving water. I almost feel like I could float. Then I see one of those big whales, a huge, dark shape in the water below me. The dolphins at my side swim away, and I have the chance for one last gasp of air before I sink through the water down to the whale. I feel calm. I know I can't breathe water, but I also feel I shouldn't. It's a strange kind of knowing. My body is speaking to me. The whale looks at me with one dark eye, larger than my head. Will it sing? I wait, but it does not. Instead, in the silence of the water, words form in my head. We are ghosts. We remember life in the living water, and now we are made flesh again, but not on earth that was. This is not home. Let us be ghosts again. But you are beautiful, I say. The Neen cherish you, most of all beings from our world. They long for your children. There is a long silence, and I do not know if the whale has understood me. Let us be ghosts again. I will tell them. I reach out and touch its skin, firm and slick. Pressure is building in my chest, the urge to breathe, even though I know it's wrong. You need air, the whale said. It rose, holding out a fluke. I clung to it, fighting the urge to inhale, and when my head broke the surface of the water, I gasped so hard it hurt. In a moment, the dolphins were there bearing me up. You swim, the whale said. Do not forget again. And then it was gone. The dolphins brought me back. The Neen were surprised to see me in the tank, with dolphins, not dead. I clung to the tank edge for a while, rubbing dolphin heads while they splashed me, laughing. The Neen watched in consternation. After a while, I got tired of their bulbous gaze. I took a deep breath and dived, head first. The dolphins followed. One of them offered me his fin, and I hung on as the group darted through the water. I had an important message to deliver, but it could wait a little longer.
This is Scott Youngkin reading An Impossible Matter by Sylvia Ann Hyven. Thorne had seen so many orbs on their journey. Some were large, some small. Some were red and scorching, some cold, craggy rock. But in this swirl of light, the third orb looked different. It was the color that caught his eye, blue and green, with wisps of white swirled around it. He stopped for a star blink, taking in the soft colors and the perfectly round shape. "Thorne, you're falling behind." Grand Patry's mind was soft, but unyielding, humming thoughts into Thorne's own. Thorne withdrew from Grand Patry's touch, flicking light toward the orb, and a question to Grand Patry. "Do any of the orbs have a name?" he asked, emphasizing the seriousness of his inquiry with colors of green and gold. The returning thought red bloomed. "No. Why would they? They're just physical matter. No reason to name pointless matter." Physicality and matter, Thorne thought. Those were the things that tethered you, kept you prisoner, what the schools had to flow around to proceed. Physicality hindered your thoughts, your hums, and it blocked communication and movement. "But it's beautiful, that thirdly orb," Thorne vibrated. "Might it not be of use for something?" "Of use?" Red thoughts turned purple and hazy. They were late, and Grand Patry was impatient. "Thorne, do you not pay attention to the knowledge points we cross and the information left for you in them by the befores?" The knowledge points, bright dances of light, were scattered all through the void. Thorne always obediently tapped into them when he passed them by, and he partook of the wisdom of the schools that had floated through the void before him. But often he questioned the information left behind by the befores. He particularly questioned matter. "Yes, Grand Patry, I do partake, but I just wonder sometimes." "I will tell you of the thirdly orb," Grand Patry projected black and snappish, in crisscrossy slashes of information. "If you get close to it, the gravity will pull you to the ground, and you won't be able to move. It has matter made of liquid and matter made of rock, and sometimes the rock breaks, and burning matter spews out like the burning stars we pass. The matter on the orb can be cold and freeze you, or char your thoughts to a crisp. It's a dangerous place." "Could," he hesitated, "could anything live there?" There came a shimmy of laughter. "Live? Oh, Thorne, you are but a youngling. No, nothing can live on an orb. For that, you'd have to be made of matter." Thorne forced out the obvious reply. "And that's impossible." "Indeed." The thoughts came gentler now, not so impatient. "You must partake more from the knowledge points, Thorne. You must leave these childish thoughts and fantasies behind." Thorne wanted to protest. He wanted to say that Grand Patry was too stubborn, too old, and too assuming, too unwilling to consider that the impossible might be possible. Perhaps things of matter could exist, only in such a different way nobody had thought of them yet. But Grand Patry floated on, and Thorne had no time to protest. He caressed the thirdly orb with one last vibration, storing its blue and green colors in his mind, and perhaps it was just in his imagination, but for a fleeting moment, Thorne imagined something vibrated back.
This is Eric Benroot. The title is "I Won at Nasuhimo" by Marissa Lingen. October 30th. I am so excited for this year's Nasuhimo. I know we're not supposed to do any of the work in advance, but that doesn't mean you can't prepare for your strategies, and I definitely am. I've read all the forums from previous years to see who had the most success. I even made a spreadsheet. It looks to me like radiation is the best option, but it obviously depends on what kind of radiation you can get access to. The Mecha suits options are the most reliable for people with engineering degrees, but mine was in communication studies. Knowing how to communicate is valuable in any field, so I'm sure it'll make me an important member of whatever superhero team I join, once I get my powers. Which will be before December 1st, if everything goes according to plan. I can't wait for the first meetup. Part of the point of pursuing superpowers in November is to have a community to encourage you and keep you accountable. I've always felt sure that I was destined for powers. This year, I'm finally going to make it happen. November 3rd. I slathered myself with aloe lotion before heading to the coffee shop for the meetup. 2 days of radiation experiments have left me with nothing more super than a sunburn. Harumph. But at least today I could meet some of my forum friends and fellow strivers after the super life. Anastasia was not at all what I expected. She was so full of energy, so cheerful, so perky. It was hard to believe that she wasn't super already. Maybe it was all the espresso. She also came prepared with syringes of radioactive spider venom. It has to go into the bloodstream, she told me. The online forums put all forms of radioactivity exposure together when they calculate success rates. But the skin is an effective blocker of most potent types of radioactivity. Injectables give you a far better odd. It's science. She had injected Laurel and Fran before the non-sequiturs barged into the coffee shop bathroom and confiscated the syringes. Sometimes, Anastasia said darkly to the rest of us, the established super community is less supportive than we might hope. It's okay, though. There are already 3 people with that radioactive spider venom. More if Anastasia gave some to Lewis before they got to the coffee shop. I saw how they look at each other. Those people will all have the same superpowers. I have a plan that will make me a completely unique new force on the super scene tomorrow. November 8, 5 days of testing the irradiated rattlesnake serum. I guess the pet shop clerk really meant it when she said that much radiation could render it completely inert. At this rate, I will turn up for the next meeting with no powers again. This is terrible. November 9, panicked and played puzzle games on my phone all day. This cannot continue. I'll stay up all night before the meeting getting my next plan into shape. I can sleep when Nasuhimo is over and I have my superpowers. Or maybe I'll get powers where I don't need to sleep. That'd be awesome. November 10. I talked to Lewis at the meetup, and he said Anastasia's radioactive spider venom had not worked for anybody, unless you count an evening of fevers and chills and nasty rash working. I thought maybe it had worked for Anastasia herself, since she wasn't at the meetup. But no, she was apparently home trying to coax more venom out of the spiders. Sad how she's retreading the same ground over again. It's too bad she doesn't have my star map updated with the likeliest exoplanets to support life. November 13. It occurs to me that almost every alien superhero was an alien to start out with. I can't think of any superhero that was turned alien and got powers that way. Maybe if there were any alien artifacts. But there's a better way to get superheroic artifacts, I think. November 17. Missed the third meetup due to travel. The search for magical artifacts keeps turning up nothing. Everyone has already stolen all the good magical artifacts by the time I get there, which is totally not fair. One woman chased me away shouting about her land. I know it's her land. I just want the magic artifacts on it. It's not like she's using them. She had to use a shotgun to chase me, which is not very super. Kind of scary, though. November 22nd. Still traveling. I'm going to miss family Thanksgiving later this week, but it will all be worth it when I find the Ring of Power, or the Helm of Might, or whatever they don't have a lot of these things lying around at Laguna Beach. It's really inconvenient, but Nasuhimo is for people who are ready to take their superpower quest seriously. If you could just buy a Sword of Justice out of the Williams-Sonoma catalog, everyone would do it. Note to self, check Williams-Sonoma catalog anyway, just in case. It may be listed as limited edition heirloom Santoku knife or something. Rustic pumpkin, possibly. I bet nobody else has a rustic pumpkin Sword of Justice, so that'd be pretty cool. November 30th, the last day of Nasuhimo. It's too late to build myself a mecha suit. Maybe next year. Maybe community college classes to get there? Thinking out loud here. But I was really bummed to have poured my heart and soul into this for a whole entire month and come out of it without any superpowers. I went for a walk on the beach to clear my mind. The beach is not that warm and fun in late November. I brought the metal detector just in case. Still no rings of power, and only 50 cents in change. And what's worse, there were jellyfish out on the beach where I was walking, and I didn't notice until I couldn't get clear of them. My feet got stung so badly I could barely walk home. I'm going to finish this final failed diary entry and go to bed without any great magical powers. December 3. I woke up with my head feeling 5 times its normal size. Apparently I slept through 2 days. Oops, I guess Nasuhima took a lot out of me. Went into the bathroom without turning on the light and discovered that I glow faintly. What? What is this? My thumbs also have tiny stinging tentacles along the side, and I'm really hungry for caviar. Take that, Anastasia. Spiders have been done already. Jellyfish are the way to go. The non-sequiturs and bird brain tell me that it's very rare for powers to intensify after they show up, so I'd better explore what I've got out of this. I tried to go swimming to see if I had any superpowers related to that, but I came up sputtering and coughing. Apparently not. I don't care, though. I am Sindaria Girl. Maybe the name needs a little work. Jelly Woman sounds like I make jam, though. Must brainstorm. And I still have to figure out what about the costume. But I won at Nasuhima, and that's what really matters.
I'm Melanie Simmons, and this is Sexbot Sunday Jigsaw Puzzle by Leslie J. Anderson. The women lounged in Maria's white-carpeted dining room in tight jeans and bright t-shirts, advertising places like Florida's Gator World and the happiest place in Vegas. Each one had been carefully selected for this gathering on business trips. Each woman stood before racks of clothing, laughing to themselves, imagining which shirt would make their friends laugh, laughing alone, their feet sore in tight leather heels. Now, in the living room, they laughed and stretched, savoring the weekend freedom from suits and fitted blouses, and another smiled as if to say, "Yes, that exact thing is divine." Maria passed around cups of dark red tea as the women watched the sexbots struggle with their puzzle. There was one for each woman, dressed in their own tight jeans and floppy t-shirts, since it seemed ridiculous to keep them in lace and velvet on their day off. It was Coral's idea to bring the sexbots to tea, because, she said, she didn't want to leave hers unattended. What if the children came home early and played with it? Coral worried. What indeed, everyone agreed. Not that the thing would do anything to them, but it was the very idea. It was Barbara's idea to teach them the puzzle. The bots were smart, really. They came with basic programming, and anything more complicated than that had to be downloaded. But they only had to show them how to fit the pieces together once, and they slowly started going at it. Silent, dull eyes wide and serious. "They're almost cute like that," Barbara said. "They look like our daughters." Which they did, except each one had a little red light on the back of their necks. "Oh, Barbara, that's disgusting," Coral said. "They're not that bad," Barbara said. "I think they're a lifesaver. By the time I'm home from work, check in with the board, get the kids, cook dinner, all I want to do is have a glass of wine and watch Antique Roadshow and go to bed. And here's Jacob, God love him, and he has needs." She kissed the air, her wet red lipstick a threat to the white carpet, the clean, clean napkins. The women laughed. "Needs is right," Sophie said. "It's like being poked with a stick. Now hold on, honey. Let me finish folding socks, and then I'll be totally hot for you in my sweaty bra and work hair. I want to feel sexy if we're going to be sexy." "I think I have more sex now," Barbara said, and stuffed a whole white chocolate-dipped strawberry in her mouth. A bit of chocolate fell on the carpet, and a robot, the size and shape of a water bug, skittered out from under the hall tree and scooped it up. It disappeared under another piece of furniture with a sound like a tiny sigh. "Oh, come on," Coral said. "No, honestly," Barbara said around the strawberry. "It doesn't bother me. Jerry can have some fun, and I can have some fun when he's not home." "It bothers me," Coral said, and Sophie glared at her. She wanted to know more about when Jerry wasn't home. "Coral, will you help me in the kitchen for a moment?" Maria said. She held an empty plate like a waitress on an old poster. She held it like it was the best and most important plate in the world. Her smile was porcelain, carefully crafted for straight-backed, black-suited investors. Coral picked up the strawberry plate, now empty of strawberries, and followed her to the kitchen. The sexbots were passing a single piece around in a circle, turning it over carefully, pursing their lips. Barbara's bot tapped her tiny foot once, twice, abandoned the piece on the corner of the table, gave it a tiny push towards the edge, as if it had displeased her. In the kitchen, the tea kettle tap-danced on the counter and tipped its top like a hat. Maria gave it a flick, and it settled back down. "All right, tell me," Maria said. "It's nothing," Coral said. "Now, please." "I am not having more sex. I am having none." "Oh, sweetie. He told me I would be sorry when we bought the thing, and I didn't believe him. But he's right. He barely speaks to me or the kids. He just..." She gestured toward the living room where the bots struggled with their puzzle. "Oh, sweetie, you have to be brave. Make your own decisions." And she was cut off by a roar of laughter from the dining room. Maria's bot walked past the door, her hips swinging, the little light on her neck blinking red. "Oh, no," Maria said, clamping a hand over a laugh. "Charlie's up and he doesn't know we're here." But he must have heard the laughter or the applause, because he appeared a few minutes later, red-faced, and the bot returned to the table. "We have company, dear," Maria said. "I see that. Sorry, ladies." Maria tried to bring the conversation back to Coral again, but the moment was gone. The closeness evaporated, and they talked about cereal and children and work. "Oop, someone's calling," Coral pointed at the light on Barbara's bot. "I'll get the car," Barbara sighed from the dining room, "or it'll just start walking down the road. Come on, bot. Maybe we should leave them behind after all." "Sophie, look!" Sophie leaned over the kitchen island to see where Cora was pointing. Barbara's bot hadn't walked out the door yet. It was leaning over the folding table. The other bot stopped too, waiting. Barbara's bot put down the piece in her hand and picked up the impossible piece, the piece abandoned on the corner of the table. She swayed, but stayed, and stayed, and stayed. Barbara jingled her keys. "Well," said Coral, "there's that now." "Yes," Sophie sighed. "What do we do about that?"
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrood. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.